Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you this morning. And it's interesting. My career was in television broadcasting, but you look back on it and you sort of think, wow, you know, sort of that was pretty bland, pretty ordinary. But I was going through some of the things for this talk this morning, and you look back at it and you go, gee, we did cover some ground. But just to explain a little bit, obviously my name's Peter Jauncey, and I've lived in Bradbow for the last 15 years, and I lived in Canberra for the previous 30 to that. Basically, to answer a lot of the questions that people who don't know me ask, is I'm Australian born, and I grew up in the United States, and I came back to Australia when I finished high school in 1963. So that's getting up about 55 years. So they say the accent you have when you're 17 years old is the accent you'll have for the rest of your life, and that seems to be pretty true. One thing you don't want to ever hear me is when I'm trying to speak Strine. It's a terrible thing. So anyway, how did I get into television in the first place? Well, when I came back, I was working for a company in Canada in 1967. And I came back to Australia because I was interested in this young lady in Brisbane. And so I got back and I said, okay, you know, sort of, there wasn't much call for seismic playback operators around at that time, which I worked as a seismic playback operator in Australia, and then I was transferred to Canada working for an oil company. So anyway, a friend of mine sort of said, well, hey, why don't you try radio and television? You know, sort of see what sort of opportunities are there for an electronic operator. So I did. I wrote to every radio station, every television station in Brisbane. I got two letters back. One said, thank you, but no thank you. And the other one said, hey, well, you know, from Channel 7 in Brisbane, said, come on up and let's have a talk. And this was in early 1968. Now, to briefly, I'm sure everybody remembers television in 1968. Well, it was, you know, there was black and white. And we used to go on air at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we'd shut down and go home at 10:30 at night. And until we would then, I can remember on Saturday where we became very, very thing, and we went on air at 8 o'clock on a Saturday morning with cartoons, and everybody thought, that's wow, that's radical. So in those early days, you know, sort of that, I even go back to a point where one of the first shows that probably anybody would remember that I worked on was Homicide. Any of you remember Homicide? Yeah, I was a CCU operator for that, which is a camera control operator, which is a technician that looks after cameras. And later on, in, I think it was about 73 or something, when we were doing, used to do football games, and I set a record for myself that year. I did 57 rugby league games for the season. That's every Wednesday night, Friday night, Saturday, Sunday, and then there were tests and there was all those other ones for the year. And that was all with the Brisbane Rugby League. People in Brisbane at that stage probably wouldn't even be able to give you the names of two or three of the Sydney teams. So it was interesting because we used to go out and our outside broadcast truck was quite large. We had three cameras. If you remember back into the early days before the Packer Circus, we'd go out and we'd do football games with three cameras, and oftentimes I can remember the ABC doing cricket with two cameras. And nowadays, you sort of like the recent Super Bowl things like that. They had 110 cameras and 300 or 400 people. We used to go out with 6 technicians to go out and set up our 3 cameras, and then we'd have the cameraman and director would show up in the afternoon, so there'd be 4 or 5 of them. And so that was our whole crew. So it's just, you know, how we did there. And one of these games, that one of our cameramen got sick. We used to have, the way we used to set it up, we had a camera up high on the 50 yard, and this was in the old Lang Park. So you'd have one camera high on the 50 yard line, so you cover the game that way. You had another one on the ground beneath him on the 50 yard line, and he would do the close ups. We had a third camera, which was down in the end zone. And I was a maintenance technician. So this one particular day, this cameraman got sick, and there's not a whole lot to do for a maintenance technician to do once everything's set up and we're running. So they sort of said, "Hey, why don't you, you know, sort of operate the camera that, you know, down the end zone?" The director says, "Look, if the shots isn't any good, I won't take it." So I said, "Okay, yeah, that sounds like that could be fun rather than sitting around the OB van with nothing much to do." So anyway, I was down there on the edge of the end zone and going through this game, and most of the time the action was happening down the other end of the field anyway, so you know, it was minimal camera movement. And you said, "Hey, this is pretty cool, man. You know, this is easy." Until there was a fellow, and I'll always remember, he's now a prominent Fijian football player, a guy named Athali Badibasaga. And anyway, he was a winger, and he comes flying down the sideline, and I'm, you know, sort of coming toward me, and he gets about five meters out from the line, and he makes that big fly, and he flies past me, you know, sort of prone with the ball, and does his thing. And then, you know, so I'm like, "Hey, man, this is fantastic. This is great, you know, great shot." And basically, at the last minute, I pulled focus the wrong way. This ended up being the try of the year, and it was shown probably 50 times. And every time, everybody in the whole television station would come up to me and tell me about it. So I've since decided, you know, sort of, yeah, and I'll say, being a technician, camera work was probably not one of my big things. One of the big, you know, innovations that came along is 1972, remember the election of 1972, Gough Whitlam was elected, and we're in Brisbane. There were no networks. And normally what we did for news footage is they would put it onto film in Sydney, take it to the airport, put it on the airplane, send it to Brisbane, and we put it in next night's news. But with something like that, particularly the 72 election, that was a big deal. So we were actually set up microwave dishes where we would take it off air from Channel 7 in Sydney. Well, we went from Canberra through, I think we put it up on the jib in, they had a microwave set up on the jib in Barrow to get the signal to Sydney. And then Newcastle took it off air and retransmitted it at Newcastle, and that sent it up to, I think it was about Taree. They put another microwave dish in somebody's backyard, and then they transferred that to Port Macquarie and on up to Brisbane. By the time we put it there in Brisbane, I'm sure most people can remember the rural signal that we used to watch television. You could, through the snow, you could just see the picture. Sometimes you could get sound, but it was all crackly. We used to think that was cool to watch in television. And this was, this was the kind of signal in 72 that we put down. And oftentimes you describe, you know, sort of the number of people, the technology, you know, that was cutting edge, man. That was really cool. And nowadays, you know, people sort of say, "Well, you know, I want it 2 seconds. And if I don't get it in 2 seconds, I'm bored." And so it was, you know, the they took it that way. And then in 74, we went color. And the technology of color television was, you know, of how color television worked, the basic theory, it's fairly straightforward. The biggest thing that we had was we were going from valve equipment, and we were moving past the solid state times, and we were moving direct into integrated circuits. And that was the greater technology barrier. Like, we were going from units that were, you know, sort of this big, this high, to suddenly being that big. And trying, and as technicians, we're trying to fix this stuff, understand what it's all happening. And so, it was a very dramatic, if you like, but the change and the impact the change had on our society, as well as it, keeping in mind in that time, we also started working into networking kind of situations. And I was up on, we're doing we're covering one of the first things that we got via the networks was the what's the football game in England, the big soccer one in May, FA Cup. Sorry, I lost it there for a moment. But we're doing the FA Cup. We're up on Mount Cravat in Brisbane, which is where the Telstra Tower is. And there was myself and another fellow, and we're setting up this thing. So we're going to take the FA Cup off the bearer from Telstra, beam it across to Channel 7 for the show, which I think the game starts at about midnight. And anyway, we're up there, and we're doing pan and tilt with the old dish, and you know, with the horn on the end. And we're up there, and I'm in the van doing the twiddling knobs, and a fellow's there doing it, you know, one pan and then tilt. And a young boy, about 10 years old, comes up to him, and he says, "Hey, mister, what you doing?" And he says, we're setting up this." This ray gun. He said, "See those ships down there in the river?" He says, "What we're going to do is we're going to, you know, turn it around, and then then man in the truck there, he's going to hit the button, and zap, it's going to be going." "Golly, really, mister?" And he says, "Nah." He says, "I'm pulling you. We got the FA Football Cup, and we're going to send it over there to that television tower." And it put up, not, he was much happier with the first explanation. We were going to zap these things. Then in 75, probably one of the biggest things in the television industry that's ever really occurred came along. In 75, we had the dismissal. There were no television facilities in Parliament House at that time. Okay, by that time we had preliminary sort of networking kind of arrangements that were, weren't quick, but you could get it done. And so when the dismissal, they actually had to take the outside broadcast band from CDC Channel 7, take it, park it in front of the steps of Old Parliament House. So when you see the pictures of Mr. Whitlam, you know, sort of talking about the Governor General and all those sort of things, they're never inside the building because there was no facilities inside the building. And what happened is then, after, you know, all the television networks sort of said, "Whoa, you know, sort of we need to do something, and we need to do it." I came to Canberra right after that, and one of my first tasks, I was working for CTC Channel 7. In Canberra, or Super 7, or Capital 7, all its various manifestations. And my job was to, CDC had contracted to 7, 9, and 10 networks to look after their equipment. We supplied engineering support. So most of them had one journalist and one cameraman. And I'd go up and look after, their equipment. And one day I was up in Channel 9's office And, you know, so basically where these television things were, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the old Parliament House, but it was the world's greatest fire trap. And we're in this little office, and I was just doing some tweaks on the camera, and Peter Harvey, now hopefully people remember Peter Harvey, yeah. Gravel voice for Channel 9, came in and says, oh, I've got an interview with Mr. Whitlam, and, you know, sort of, can you get the camera going? So I put the slides back on and got that all ready. And the way that it used to work was there'd be a desk in this little tiny room, and so the desk was Mr. Harvey's, you know, his office desk, and then we put a picture on the wall behind it of something to do with Parliament, and then over here, the other side of the room was probably about this far, we had a rack of equipment, you know, video recorders and that kind of stuff, and the camera. The camera had to be way over here because it couldn't get focus any closer with those gear. And oftentimes when you did interviews up, you had to put the camera out into the hallway because of the rooms are so small. And anyway, so Mr. Whitlam comes in, and we're sitting down, and we're going through, and the phone rings. And Peter Harvey would sit this side of the desk, so he'd be over the shoulder shot of Mr. Whitlam. And Mr. Whitlam reached over and grabbed the phone first. And the conversation went something like this. Whitlam here. And then there was that pause. Gough Whitlam. And then there's another pause. How many Whitlams do you know? And Mr. Harvey's here, you know, sort of trying to get to the phone. And eventually, you know, then Mr. Whitlam just sort of says, yeah, no, sir. Yes, that might be a good idea to phone back later. Then we followed on. We did our interview, and it was basically it was the Channel 7 cameraman calling the Channel 9 cameraman to say, let's go and have a coffee. And then, so when it came on, the Channel 7 cameraman was thinking, you know, it was the Channel 9 guy, you know, just putting on his voice. So. But that was, you know, sort of one of those things. And then in 77 then, basically, you know, sort of I was heavily involved in putting cameras in cars at Bathurst and putting cameras in helicopters. Up until that stage, that they used to shoot, the helicopter would go and shoot on film, drop the film down, they would process it and play it later in the day for things. And then they got very modern with when we came out with the little video cassettes, because now we could go up there and he could record it onto videotape, land and give it to him, and we could have that video basically edited and, you know, online in probably about a half an hour. And that was pretty cool. I was involved with it when they wanted to put microwave transmitters in the helicopter, and it was one of the cameras that I was responsible for that was the first camera that we actually went live from the helicopter. And then they decided, oh yeah, that works pretty cool. Now let's work out how we're going to put a camera in the car. So we put the camera in the car. The big fellas, Rocky and all those things, didn't want a camera in their car because they didn't, you know, there was in the event of a crash, you know, you don't want anything, you know, sort of floating around inside, rattling around inside. So we developed the pen and tilt head, and we put this in hardened steel. This camera wasn't going anywhere. And there was one day, and it was Peter, there's a Toyota that was the first car we put this. Pardon? No, he was at Campbelltown. He had a Toyota dealership, Peter Livingston or something like that. Anyway, so we put this in and we were, you know, running tests, and We went around to him one day, at this on the late on the Saturday afternoon, the day before the race. And we sort of said, hey, we just want to check out the microwave, because the microwave problems are, because you're on a hill, you get a lot of reflection. And so we went around, and you know, we said, can we take it? I said, oh, man, he says, I just put the racing engine in it. He says, no, can you really need to? And we sort of said, yeah, we've got a couple of things we need to sort out. So, okay. He said, okay, we'll take, you know, go out with the racing engine in it and everything. And so he went around and we're doing this test, and all of a sudden the screen turns brown. Television screens don't turn brown. And that's a, you know, so if it went green or blue or red, you know, you could understand. It goes brown. What's this? And we're scratching our heads. And then over the PA system, it sort of said, just now, so-and-so, Toyota has hit the wall in the cutting. And in fact, it was the out-of-focus rock wall not that far in front. So anyway, they go out with a tow truck and they hold the car back into the pits. And we're sort of saying, you know, this is, you know, he ain't going to be happy about this. That was his, you know, that he didn't want to take it out. So we did the honorable thing and picked the lowest level apprentice to go get the camera. So anyway, but then we came back and we said, you know, so yeah. The kid came back with this and, you know, he said, oh, he's still alive. And he said, no, he's more worried about the camera. And he said, the car is not a problem. He'll have that fixed and ready for the morning. He said, he just wants to make sure that the camera's all right. So then in 83, we had Gough Whitlam, or not Gough Whitlam, we had Bob Hawke became the Prime Minister. And I was at Government House, and we were recording the commissioning for with Sir Ninian Stephen. And so if you remember Sir Ninian, he's the one with corn cob pipe. And we're setting up his office. We got to put lights and microphones and all that sort of stuff and rearrange the furniture so it looks nice. And anyway, so Ninian Stephen's there. He's got his feet up on the coffee table in the little ante room next to it, smoking his pipe. And so then Bob Hawke arrives, and Bob Hawke's, you know, in morning suit and all that sort of stuff. So they both get up, you know, tidy, straighten ties and come sit down. And then we just start the interview. Or not the interview, the process, where the Governor General, on behalf of the Queen, commissions Bob Hawke to form a new government. And so there's this fly, you know. So Ninian Stephen turns around and he says, now, can you just hold the recording? And so then Sir Ninian Stephen and Bob Hawke, both of them, grabbed magazines off the table, climbed up on chairs and on top of the table. And eventually they dispatched this poor fly. And then they get down, straighten the ties, everything, back to normal. And then Mr. Hawke accepts the commission of the Queen to form a government. You know. And then in 90, and I moved across to Parliament House, and we moved into the new building, and we were going to televise the proceedings of Parliament, which you see now, Question Time, that sort of stuff. And they got there, and they built the building with $110 million worth of equipment, beautiful equipment. And then they said, okay, how are we going to do this? And everybody said, oh, I don't know. So I went across as a technical producer with them, and while I was there, then I did two presidential visits with where we had, you know, sort of 40 cameras and doing it in multiple languages, 300 journalists, all that sort of stuff. And there was one day where we wanted to do the rules of Parliament House as far as cameras and recording are very, very strict. You cannot take pictures anywhere in the building. You cannot you know, just recorded, because the wheeling and dealing goes on in the hallways, and nobody, they don't want anybody to record or to have you know, take photographs of it. And we had a request from one of the networks that they wanted us to record a stand up in front of the doors to the House of Representatives in the Senate are very elaborate. And so we did this, but you have to ask permission. So we called the speaker's office and said, "Can I shoot this, do this recording?" And we wanted to do this shoot in front of the thing. And about 5 minutes later, we got a phone call from security, sort of saying, "You want to do what in front of the doors of the House of Reps?" And we're sort of saying, "We're the Sound and Vision Office, yes." Because the security was, they heard the idea. We wanted to shoot this journalist in front of the door. Sometimes they can become a little paranoid. But just to finish off, I also want to tell you about two men that I had a lot of, you know, well, not a lot. One of these guys was, he gave me my first job. It was a summer job. He was a plumber, and a lovely Christian man. And basically, he was going to fire me three times. Basically, I was 15 years old. We're out in West Texas, where it's 100 days over 100 degrees in the summertime. And the main thing I was doing was digging up sewage pipes. So basically, yeah, and being 15. That you're never doing it right, you know. You're taking shortcuts and you're doing all that. And he was very patient, but he even though he sort of wanted to, he sort of said that if I didn't get my act together, you know, sort of would time to move on. So he was an important man to me in that he taught me the ethics of work ethic and hard work. And there was another fellow that at the time that had a big influence on me as well. He was actually a World War I fighter pilot. Now I thought that was pretty cool. And he was telling, you know, like he was sort of saying that when they talk about the Dawn Patrol, and he says, well, you know, the Dawn Patrol was always so dangerous. He says, that's because you had to go out over the trenches first at first light. Because that was the only way you had to find out who's in the trenches, because they may have changed hands through the night, and so that, you know, you could get the information back, because communications are normally cut and we're pretty poor anyway. And he said, the only way you can tell who's in the trenches is you had to fly low enough to see what color uniforms they were wearing, because they don't put up flags and, you know, that sort of stuff. So basically, yeah, and he says, when you're flying that low, you know, sort of, there's people shooting at you, both sides. And the German flyers, they're out doing the same thing, trying to ascertain, you know, where everybody is. And anyway, so that in the course of this one day, this fellow flew through a cloud of mustard gas. Not enough to kill him, but enough to limit him for the rest of his life. So anyway, so this guy, then when the war finished, he became a lighting technician. Maybe that's why I went into some of the things that I did too. But he also was a honorary medicine man to the Apache Mescalero Indians. And this guy, because of the mustard gas, he could hardly walk. As a Christian representative to the Mescalero Apache Indians, he could dance for 24 hours nonstop. And he was one of the most, you know, amazing little guys. He was just a little guy. I guess they had to be. He couldn't fit in a fighter plane if they got too big. So he was that, you know, sort of an amazing. But one of the main things that I wanted to mention about these guys is that even though they were important in my life and all this, I doubt if they had any idea that they had an effect on my life. To a point where I think when they got to heaven and looked in the book of life and saw their names there, you know, and they sort of said, who's that? And then when it was explained who I am, they said, that snotty-nosed little kid. But the point of it is, oftentimes we say we can't witness, we can't talk to other people, and I don't like it either. But it doesn't matter. You may have already done it 50 years ago. And it's not necessarily what we say, it's who we are and how we are. And one of the verses I'd like to just leave you with for you to think about is 2 Timothy 2:15. And it's been important to me. Do your best to present yourself to God as one approved, a worker who does not need to be ashamed and who correctly handles the word of truth. Now, the definition of worker and, or as another one, show yourself approved, or what do you determine as approved? That's for each and every one of you to sort out yourself. And as we go through, I hope that when I get to the other side, that I'll see my name in the book of life, and there'll be some snotty-nosed kid that sort of said, hey, he made a difference. So...